Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Matt Dickinson. Matt, how are you doing? How have you been keeping?
Yeah, I've been keeping good. Well, we're into the countdown now, aren't we? Till football football resumes. So I can see a new world opening up, at least in a footballing sense, and that has to be something to look forward to. At last, we can look forward.
Indeed, absolutely. Have you been given any sort of guidance on what happens with journalists like yourself?
Yeah, well, I've been talking a lot about that with the office. We're still waiting for final confirmation, but you know, we think probably at the Premier League level, it's going to be one of us per paper allowed in for a game. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I suspect we'll be, yeah, parking will be the easy bit. I imagine there's obviously going to be temperature tests for each of us going in, and then obviously segregation. I mean, how any kind of sort of press conference works afterwards, we're still waiting for final details. And obviously, there's going to just be I've done a few behind closed games before, and yes, they are different. We'll take football any which way at the moment. But yeah, it's going to be a really quite surreal and different experience. But you know, it's not going to be football as we know it. But it will throw up all kinds of other interesting stories. We've been talking about, you know, obviously we'll have to look at the Bundesliga has already shown how the pattern of games can change, the intensity of games can change, the time of the ball's in play. Obviously, we've got the fascination of seeing which teams come back fitter than others, you know, which players are fitter than others. And also, I guess, the fact that the season somehow suddenly feels very unpredictable again, depending on how those teams come back and how prepared they are. So there will be plenty to discuss, plenty of stories around. And, you know, football is one of the sort of great, you know, distractions, and it will be again.
It certainly will. Gregor, you can hear it in the way Matt's talking. He's excited about it coming back. Are you equally as excited?
I am, although I have to be brutally honest, and when I saw the fixtures released and saw how there was basically a game every day, that I'm slightly daunted by the prospect of watching that much football, because I'm very excited to have it back, but they're certainly squeezing the games in. I know they have to. But it's going to be like a kind of World Cup to finish the season. It's going to be brilliant football every day.
Yeah, although of course, if you live with someone who doesn't like football, then the next month or so is just not for them. Neither is this pod, of course. But coming up, we are going to be talking about the ever-changing role of the on-field captain and what could be the next big barrier to be broken down in football. But first, it's time for this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Okay, let's start with some exciting news for Chelsea fans. They have agreed a deal in principle to sign striker Timo Werner from RB Leipzig. The German international has a €55 million release clause, which expires on the 15th of June. It's set to be a £200,000 a week contract for Werner, who has also sparked interest from Liverpool and Manchester United, but the pair were not willing to pay the release clause. Over the last 4 years, the 24-year-old versatile forward has established himself as one of the most exciting young players in the Bundesliga, and his stats are impressive. 31 goals in 40 games this season, taking his overall total for RB Leipzig to 92 in 154. He's got 11 goals and 29 for Germany. 4 goals in the Champions League, one of which came during Leipzig's 1-0 win at Tottenham in February. He has also amassed close to 300 senior appearances since making his professional debut for Stuttgart in 2013, but actually only turned 24 in March. So, Gregor, let's come to you first on Mr. Werner. Does this look like this is going to be money well spent for Chelsea?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think he's one of the hottest strikers in Europe, undoubtedly. He's also versatile in that he can play on the wing, probably more comfortably from the left. But he's, and I think he really is a converted winger, but he's become a real poacher at RB Leipzig. So, you know, that versatility, I think, is very valuable nowadays for teams that play with a front three. And he's, as you've sort of alluded to there, experienced a lot for his age. He's been playing first team football since the age of 17. He was a real kind of Wunderkind at Stuttgart.
Well,
do you like my German
there?
Do you like that?
German, Gregor.
Sorry. but he had a tough time there as well, because I think Stuttgart went down. They were relegated when he was there, and it was kind of, you know, there was a lot of pressure heaped on his shoulders for someone so young. But then at Leipzig, he's improved year on year, first under Ralf Hasenhüttl, who's obviously the Southampton manager now. And then, especially this year under Nagelsmann, he's, I think, 25 league goals and 8 assists in 30 league games. So, a key player for Germany, as you say, he's just turned 24, not yet at his peak. The only thing is the fee. You've got to say, you know, it's 55 million, that's the reported release clause in his contract. That was before the world came kind of crashing down. That was a pre-COVID valuation. Obviously, Liverpool hesitated at that. And it's a heck of a lot of money to spend, given the uncertainty in the world just now. So, you know, money aside, undoubtedly, he's someone who most elite football clubs, I think, would have been delighted to have in their team for next season.
If you believe speculation, Matt, there was a suggestion that he did prefer a move to Liverpool. In that respect, should Chelsea fans be a little bit worried about that?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, you could understand why he'd want to move to Liverpool. You know, they're the dominant force at the moment, aren't they? And certainly in England, and have you know shown it in Europe as well. So I could understand why. And you know, who wouldn't want to play for Jurgen Klopp? Chelsea obviously is a team that's been in a bit of transition, still a young manager, sort of finding his way. But you know, plenty to appeal there as well, not least that 200,000 quid a week you mentioned. But no, I think that's just the nature of football. You know, club top players will look at their options, probably hope, you know, that the biggest clubs in the world come in for him. But Chelsea's not a bad place to land, and yeah, I think it's going to be exciting, not just to see how he does, but how that affects the pecking order at Chelsea, who sort of Frank Lampard goes for as his sort of, you know, first choice, first three, if there is such a thing.
Well, having been lauded for using academy players, which of course we know was forced upon them due to last summer's transfer embargo, do you think then, Matt, there is a bit of a fear that some of them might now get overlooked, some of those younger players, because of the fact that Chelsea have won their appeal against that two-window ban, reduced to just last summer? They can now make signings. So what happens in that situation with those young players that were coming through, but now Chelsea can spend?
Well, I think that, you know, that is the reality of certainly of the English top flight, isn't it? And I think, you know, if we're getting specific, it's Hudson-Odoi who probably is the one with the most to look over his shoulder about. I think Tammy Abraham's a very different type of player to Timo Werner. You know, he's, as Gregor says, he would be more likely, he's a goal poacher and a goal scorer, but seems perhaps best used to be coming off the left flank. And I think, you know, so I think Hudson-Odoi is the one that's got the most to prove. And I don't think that's a new thing. I do think there's been questions that I'm aware of about you know, his attitude and application. Not, you know, not that he's entirely lacking in it, but just that there's more to come from him and more for him to prove. And this adds to that, shall we say, sort of pressure and expectation on him. And you know, if you're going to succeed at the big clubs, that comes with the territory.
Well, Werner is set to join Hakim Ziyech, who's joining from Ajax for £33 million on July the 1st, as new additions at Stamford Bridge this summer follow that transfer ban. The club are also interested in bringing in a new left-back with Leicester's Ben Chilwell, their number one target. Gregor, Chelsea, it seems, aren't hanging around in terms of recruitment then for next season. So does Frank Lampard deserve more credit for the job he's done at Chelsea so far?
No, I don't think so. I think he's getting the credit he deserves. I think, look, let's be honest, he inherited a team that finished third last season on 72 points. And with 9 games to play, they're fourth with 48 points. So, you know, I think in February, in fact, late February, they had the lowest points haul of any fourth place team since 2004. So, obviously, as you've mentioned, there were circumstances. There was a transfer ban. He had to utilise the academy players more so. I think he would have been someone who'd been willing to do that anyway, and that willingness has been part of the reason he was brought to the club, and it's part of the reason why the fans are kind of doubly excited about the future under him. So I think what you can say is that he's convinced. He's certainly done enough to convince the hierarchy of the football club that he was a risk. He'd only had 1 year at Derby County, but he's done enough to convince Abramovich and Marina Granovskaya, and now Petr Cech as well, obviously, who's a technical performance advisor. So, you know, I think having some harmony, there's always seems to be with with Chelsea, there's either they show their willingness and intent in the transfer market early in the summer and they get the business done, and, you know, that usually heralds a successful season, or it's absolute turmoil and, you know, there's a sullen manager in the dugout like Mourinho or Conte, and that usually signals there's going to be a tough season. So I would say that this obviously points towards more success, and if Chelsea were to add a couple of more players, I think a left back and a centre half, probably most importantly, they'd certainly be looking at narrowing that gap.
So, Gregor, you're optimistic that it all points to success. Matt, when you consider where Chelsea are right now, they're fourth in the table. As we mentioned, had to use a lot of their academy players, and they're fourth in the table without Eden Hazard as well. So how far away do you think Chelsea could be from becoming title contenders one day?
Well, that's a big call. You know, you look at pure points, and they're as near to the bottom three is the top one, I think. I mean, obviously that's a bit freakish with Liverpool's extraordinary points tally. But I think Greg is right. Look, these are exciting signings. You know, certainly I think Chelsea have been, you know, very decent to watch many times under Lampard. These signings should make them, give them a real sort of box office feel about them. But I think it's, you know, he's a young manager still learning on the job. I think he's going to make plenty more mistakes as he learns on the job. Equally, I think he's a bright guy who will learn from those mistakes. But yeah, I think it's too much to expect that they suddenly sort of surge, you know, the 20 plus points that they're going to need to become title contenders. I think they're, if I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be really encouraged. But I think, you know, let's sort of take it one step at a time.
But that all said, Gregor, with these signings that they're potentially making, they will expect, and I'm talking about the new players, they will expect that Chelsea will be in the Champions League places next season. And that's something you think they can achieve?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's not a foregone conclusion this season. So I would expect them to get over the line. And yeah, as you say, if you're signing players of this stature, and more importantly, once the season's over, I think probably, we still don't know how the transfer window is quite going to work, but when they look to do more business, if they're wanting to be signing the kind of more marquee players, then they are going to have to be in the Champions League. So it is exciting for Chelsea, and I think it's kind of also a bit of it reaffirms Roman Abramovich's sort of commitment to this, which has kind of wavered a little bit, or there's been question marks over certainly in the last couple of years. And what, you know, with all the wave of young players coming through, and if add in a few marquee signings, I think they certainly will narrow the gap. But as Matt says, the gap to the top two, to Man City and Liverpool, is going to be very difficult to bridge in the short term.
Well, sticking with Chelsea, more reasons for them to be cheerful after a weekend of celebrations, having been awarded the Women's Super League title. The season was ended using a points per game system, and Chelsea finished with 2.6 points compared to Manchester City's 2.5, having played a game less, and were sitting second when the campaign was halted by coronavirus in March. It means that Emma Hayes has won her 7th trophy in 8 years, as well as a 4th league title. And Matt, I know you know Emma Hayes well. Just how good is she?
Well, she's certainly one of my favourite people in football, to be honest. I say that having, you know, been fortunate enough to ghostwrite, sort of help her with some columns that she did for us in the last Women's World Cup, spent, you know, some decent, really good time with her then. And I just learned so much, you know, and I guess people might assume that you would from any sort of senior figure in football. You certainly hope so. But I have to say I learned as much from her, certainly about management, about how you handle groups of players, as well as tactics. She's just got a brilliant way of communicating. She's got a really interesting take on how working obviously in the women's game, she was talking about how it's necessary for her to have a gender balance in the dressing room and how different people bring different things, and how, you know, I think if we get onto it in a minute, if she ever worked in the men's game, you know, how that would play out. And she thinks these things through really carefully. She was really interesting on, you know, researching why women seem to have a higher record of ACL injuries. She's interested, you know, she's a curious person, a very bright person, and obviously a very successful person. And I just found her just one of the most, not just interesting, but challenging person. She's the sort of person that you're interviewing, and she'll challenge you to say, well, what do you think? What's, you know, you've written this, justify it. And I think that's, you know, you can't get too many people like that in football who are open-minded and, you know, want to keep exploring potential.
She is widely regarded as one of the best coaches in the female game. She's been tipped previously to lead the England Lionesses, but has also been talked about, as you just pointed out, Matt, as a future men's team manager. Is there any reason why she couldn't make the jump, do you think, Matt, to the men's game?
I mean, the reasons I could give would all be the sort of, shall we say, the wrong reasons, in the sense of, you know, prejudice and people jumping to, you know, lazy conclusions that it's not possible, or, you know, judging her before giving her a chance. And as I say, they're certainly obstacles, and she more than anyone is aware of those obstacles. But she's also the type of person who would say, you know what, it's about trying to overcome them. And I think, you know, I've spoken about this before, that I think this is, you know, dressing rooms in the men's game would be improved by that very gender balance. You know, women bring a different perspective potentially to them. They bring a different type of conversation. They bring, you know, different qualities. And I think why is that a bad thing? I think, you know, all male groups, all women groups can, you know, can get sort of blinkered in a certain way. So I think it's, you know, obviously to you know, it's got to be a job done on the right credentials and on the right talents. But I think she certainly has an eye to it. She's talked about it before, about, you know, how wanting to give it a go. And I think it would be absolutely fascinating as and when she does give it a go. At what level, who knows? But I would be really surprised if by the end of her coaching career she hasn't tried it somewhere.
Is someone mowing the lawn, Matt?
Yeah, is that coming over a bit loud? There's someone outside who's getting rid of some shrubbery that's gone a bit wild in lockdown in a garden nearby. I apologise. Is that? It looks like he's just finished. He's just putting away his chopper, so to speak. So his chopper is. I can assure you, his chopper is firmly away.
Glad to hear it's all finished and we're done and dusted. Oh dear, Gregor. Goodness, What problems do you think a female coach would face in the men's game? Do you think football players would actually be receptive to a female coach?
I think on the whole, absolutely, yes. I did my my UEFA B licence in, I think it was 2014, with Laura Bassett, the former England defender. And she was only female candidate on the course. I think it was about 20 of us probably doing the course. And she was head and shoulders above anyone. She was the best coach out of that, really? That kind of cohort by a country mile. She had a brilliant rapport with everyone. She spoke with authority. That, you know, all the things that go along with the knowledge you would expect of someone who won 60 caps for our country, I think. So, you know, that's the slightly lazy assumptions that people make, I think, that, you know, they wouldn't be able to command command authority, or I don't see it. I don't think that's true. I think if it's the right individual and the right character, as someone certainly Emma Hayes seems to be, I think that the biggest issue would be the sort of external noise. You know, any time a female manager has taken over a men's team, often lower down, and there's only been a few instances, you know, it's made big news. And so the prospect of that happening in the Premier League or in a championship club or something like that, it would be an enormous story, and it would put so much pressure on the club, the individual, the team, everyone. So, you know, that's not a reason not to do it. It's just a reality, I think. So I think, you know, the biggest issue would be the external noise.
Yeah, well, I mean, Matt, where would you stand on it? Do you think we're at an age now where football would be accepting of a female manager in the men's game?
You know, you can't underestimate just the added burden of being the trailblazer, and that will just bring its own, you know, scrutiny. You know, you'll end up speaking for, you know, womanhood, as well as just trying to get on with your job, which is tough enough being manager of a team. You know, I think you end up being this sort of standard bearer, and that's not, you know, that's not an easy responsibility to handle, on top of, as I say, trying to, you know, take on the challenge itself of just, you know, making the best of a group of footballers. So, you know, I think that's, you know, that can seem intimidating, can seem daunting, but as I say, I think, you know, if anyone that I've met in the women's game is not going to be too daunted by it, it will be someone like Emma Hayes. I think, you know, I think possibly it, you know, might be a few years yet, but, you know, she'd want to do everything she can in the women's game first, and then feel like she, you know, she could go for it. But I think it's, you know, the most important thing is that the game itself keeps, you know, an open mind to the possibility, and why shouldn't it? I mean, that's the biggest thing to ask. I mean, it's, you know, no one can come up with a, you know, a sane rebuttal of that. Why shouldn't it happen? Why shouldn't a woman be just as capable of doing that job as any? And it's, yeah, it will happen. And, you know, I very much hope Emma Hayes is the type of person who tries to make it happen.
In the conversations you've had with Emma, Matt, she has indicated that is something she would consider doing, just maybe not yet.
Yeah, that's the sort of tone I get. You know, I think she's got enough on her plate as she is. And also, you know, young child, and I think that's, you know, that's enough to be going on with. I think she would want to do more in the women's game first. But I think as well for her, it's important just to keep the debate alive. You know, same way, you know, she's just not afraid of encouraging that debate, the same way that she wasn't afraid of talking about smaller pitch sizes for, you know, some people would sort of be scared of that type of argument and tiptoe around it and think, oh, well, is that, you know, potentially sort of belittling the women's game. She thinks, well, no, why, you know, it's a worthwhile, you know, even if they decide it's not worth doing to have smaller pitches or goals, why not discuss it? Because it might make practical sense. And I think it's the same with this. It's, look, why not discuss it? Why not talk about it? Why not think about, you know, how it can happen, why it should happen, why it should, you know, and knock down these arguments about why it shouldn't happen. And I think that's, you know, that's where the women's game, you know, again, it's back to that idea of open minds. I think she's just trying to open minds. And I think, you know, if football is such a sort of conservative with a small C world, you know, it's, you know, without turning this into a VAR debate or anything like, you know, we see any change brings this huge sort of backlash generally. And I think, you know, football needs to open its mind to, you know, a lot more potential.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, Wayne Rooney's brilliant Sunday Times column continued this weekend as the former Manchester United and England skipper, who now wears the armband for Derby County, discuss the art of captaincy. He remarks how the role has changed throughout his career, from Dave Watson, his first skipper at Everton, a loud, proud, vocal leader on the pitch, right through to the likes of David Beckham, Steven Gerrard, Duncan Ferguson, John Terry and Roy Keane, who all had their different styles, says Rooney, but all had certain qualities in common. He says they have to be consistent. They can't show weakness. They have to always show belief. If you go a goal down, you have to keep encouraging, demonstrate your calmness to everyone. The best captains I played for had different personalities, but shared those traits. So, Gregor, you've heard what Wayne Rooney has to say about a captain. What for you makes a good skipper?
Broadly agree. I think there's sort of three different categories of captain. I think there's a kind of traditional, really vocal pillar of strength. There's also a kind of a figure of calm and consistency and reliability. And the third is like a talisman, someone who's capable of winning a game on their own almost. But I think consistency is very, very high on that in the importance. I think they all have to be respected in the dressing room, and I think kind of a fearlessness. It's, and I don't mean by that, you know, drawing blood a la Terry Butcher. I just mean less prone to, or certainly better able to hide the kind of fluctuations in confidence and form that every single footballer has. So when everyone in the team looks at them, even if they are feeling those sort of seeds of self doubt that everyone has, they hide them very well. So everyone does feel those things, but you want to look at a captain and see someone who is fearless, not just in the way they play, but in the way that they approach the game.
Matt, in your time covering football, have you noticed a change in the role of a captain?
Well, I mean, I always find this a fascinating debate. You know, not least having written a book about Bobby Moore, available in all good bookshops, obviously, or online retailers. No, I mean, but, you know, that was, you know, any debate around captaincy, certainly in English football, sort of, you know, will always come back to him. And I found it fascinating researching him just to find out how, you know, he never gave a Churchillian speech. He barely spoke. You know, his style of captaincy was just to attempt to, and often, more often than not, succeed to be the best player on the pitch and the calmest player on the pitch, and just say, sort of radiate a certain assurance. But the other thing I found interesting from speaking to players from that team was, which I actually think is, the captaincy itself can be over-exaggerated, because I think the best teams generally will have a choice of captains. I think it's very rare, you know, you could maybe look at, you know, Maradona as a player and captain for Argentina, and I'm sure people can find other examples, but I think the great teams generally will throw up three or four who could be captains. You know, they're just, and I do think that's, you know, if you look at generally at the most successful teams, that's generally the case. They have, you know, three, four, five senior players who are willing to step up, take responsibility, pull on the captain's armband, be a leader, or support the guy who is carrying the armband. So, you know, the armband itself, you know, can be very symbolic. It can help lift a particular player. It can, you know, giving it to a particular player in a team. You know, we saw that Eddie Jones with Dylan Hartley. He thought Dylan Hartley would just give a different edge to the England team. So, it can be important. I say it can be representative, symbolic, meaningful, but I actually do think it also can be over-exaggerated, and that the best teams will throw up you know, 3, 4, potentially 5 captains.
Rooney compares the role to that of a cricket captain who helps pick the team and field placings, but says football captains have a less obvious role, but recalls how he wasn't afraid to use his power on the field. Rooney said this: United played Arsenal away and Louis van Gaal set us up in midfield with me, Carrick and Bastian Schweinsteiger going man-to-man against their midfielders. After 5 minutes, it clearly wasn't working, so I altered things, saying we needed to go back to our shape, but that didn't work either. And after 20 minutes, we were 3-0 down. Gregor, should a captain ever change the way a team has been asked to play during a game and so early on as well in a game?
I mean, I won't say I've ever seen a captain change the formation kind of early on in the first half of a game. Little tactical tweaks or kind of telling a player to sit deeper or to follow, to mark a man a bit more closely. Things like that on the pitch, yeah, but anything else, in my experience, ordinarily, you would consult with the manager, even if it was during the game. So, yeah, I think that could possibly go too far. Just quickly going back to what Matt was saying about, you know, teams have the best teams, the great teams having 3 or 4 candidates for captains. The thing is that most teams aren't great. So, actually, I still think I know it's actually becoming unfashionable to say this, but I still think captaincy matters a lot. I think that it almost projects the image of the team. And I think Arsenal are a prime example of this in the last couple of years. And if you look at when Xhaka or Aubameyang wear the armband, I think that's a kind of prime example of the fact that this is a team that's erratic, unsettled, and short of leaders. And I think that's more and more common now in the Premier League. I think part of that's to do with kind of the way players are developed, societal change. The game's becoming more about kind of holistic tactical kind of organisation and the, you know, the team being all powerful and supreme rather than individual brilliance. But I still think that there is definitely a role for that. And I think actually it's more apparent when a team doesn't have leaders how important it is. So, you know, some teams you're very fortunate if you have 2 or 3 candidates for a captain. But if you don't, then it's almost that smacks you in the face how important it is.
I find it fascinating, the role of a captain. And perhaps I'll ask you this, Gregor, because I'm sure players see it as a huge honour to be named a captain of a club. But as fans, do we sometimes do captains a disservice by assuming all they do is wear an armband and they're part of a coin toss?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, do you think that's what fans think of captains?
I think sometimes we just say, well, all it is they're wearing an armband. There's nothing more to it, because it's not. And I'm, you know, you can't help but sometimes refer to cricket captains and how they are so influential. They help pick the team. They obviously play on-field decisions they are actively involved in. Yet you don't tend to think of a football captain doing the same.
No, I understand. It's kind of, especially in English football, they kind of lionize the leadership qualities above anything else. I just think it kind of, I still think it's important. It's almost the way that it projects an image of the team, because who you hand the armband to says something about that football team. Whether it's because you've got a kind of, as I said before, a supremely talented individual like Messi, and you think, you know, this is the main man of this team. Or whether it's someone who is kind of an old-fashioned leader who, I don't know, I think that says something about a team as well. Or if it's, so, you know, or even Manchester City is another example. Now, it's almost, they since Vincent Kompany left, the team decided amongst them to hand it to David Silva. And I think the last season has almost borne out that who Manchester City's captain is this year almost is a constant reminder of what they've lost and how important Vincent Kompany was to them.
Of course, Rooney also discusses the British attitude towards captaincy. He says some countries place less importance on football captaincy, but in Britain, we are right to see it as a major honour. Matt, do we place too much importance on the role of the captain in Britain?
Again, it's a really interesting debate. I mean, I know as Italy have at times just given it to the most capped player, you know, as a matter of course. I do wonder whether, but this is us elevating not just the captaincy as but ourselves as a country, sort of imagining that we create great leaders, that we look for great leaders, that we love the idea, this big romantic idea of a sort of heroic English captain. You know, I think we do put that stock in it with a sort of assumption that's quite commonplace in our sort of football culture, that we can do it best, and that we're some kind of leader role in the game, and we're special in some small way. And I don't think it's obviously it's not been proven to be true in results for the English football team, but also I think it's slightly dangerous. I mean, I think, say if you go back to Maradona for Argentina and hear what pride he felt when he was given the armband. I think he maybe took it from Passarella, but that was the sort of greatest day of his life to him when he got it. We look at other sports or other countries, you can't tell me that, in rugby, the leader of the All Blacks is not a hugely important symbolic role. We saw what it's like for, say South Africa rugby to have a black captain. So I think, it is seen as massively important in other countries. And I think maybe we tell ourselves that, being England captain is somehow this elevated thing because we still cling slightly to this idea that we have a sort of special leadership place in football.
The level of detail that Wayne Rooney has gone into to being a captain. I mean, he's obviously talked about organising team meals and nights out, but also setting up an app, he says, to help new players settle into the area. Also, obviously, he's been the link between the players and the manager and had to, on the odd occasion, perhaps have conversations about bad training sessions. Gregor, in terms of what... I know we spoke about how a captain's role may have changed, but talking off the field... Is there so much more to a captain's job now?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say that I've played for a football club where they would set up an app to help.
No.
There is another side to the job, I think, that you don't see. But I wouldn't say it's kind of all-consuming. I think, as he said in this, when he first got the... was handed the armband, he sat down with Michael Carrick and Darren Fletcher, and that they highlighted that that would be something that they could help their teammates with, so they did it. I think and maybe once or twice a week you sometimes have to go in to speak to the manager or to the coaching staff to relay the thoughts of your teammates over something. It could just be something as simple as travelling times or the meals that you're eating. Honestly, very very minor things like that. So that is another side of the job, but obviously the most important part, I think, still is the way you kind of are an emblem of that team, and the way that you are someone that everyone else looks towards for either inspiration or for calm or sort of reassuredness, and that's still the most important role of being a captain.
Who's been the best captain you've played under then, Gregor?
It's hard to look beyond Des Walker, really, and that was when I made my debut as well. There was no one better, surely, in English football at that time, as a left back, and I'm a centre half that was playing left sided centre half, to make your debut and your early games in professional football alongside. He just talked to you non-stop, and there's things that he told me that were seared into my memory forever, like things about holding a defensive line. If you weren't in a line with Des when he looked over his shoulder, he would tell you about it. So, it's little things like that I remembered throughout my entire career. And the thing that is interesting and kind of probably bolsters Matt's argument is that even if you didn't give him the armband, he would have talked the same amount. But Des Walker was Des Walker. He was one of England's, one of the best defenders of his generation for England. And, so he had to have the armband, really, if he was in the team. And often alongside him was either Wes Morgan or Michael Dawson, and they both wore the armband as well, and they were future captains. One won the Premier League title and one captain Tottenham Hotspur. So those three guys stand out. And there's one guy, it's a good friend of mine as well, a guy called Jack Lester at played for Chesterfield alongside, played him at Forest too. But at Chesterfield, he was in his 30s, but he was too good for the level. If you were lined up in the tunnel with him before a game, you just felt that he could win the game single-handedly for you. So him standing at the front of the tunnel, leading the team out, you thought, we've got a good chance of winning this game because he's in our team.
Wow, I love all that. Finally then, if you could play under one captain from past or present, who would it be and why? Matt, is Bobby Moore the ultimate, do you think?
Well, he's certainly the guy with on the statue outside Wembley, and the guy who lifted the World Cup. So he's up there. But I actually would probably, if I'm going for my own personal one, I have to go to representing the England press team some years back when Terry Butcher, obviously a great sort of stalwart, classic sort of barking big centre half England captain, played led the press team, and I still remember a slightly shambolic. We were playing in the England kit. I think this game might have been in Poland. We were, you know, say fully kitted up as England, and Terry was obviously doing his sort of commentary at the time and leading the team out. And I remember him turning around and seeing this dishevelled bunch of journalists standing behind him, and we were all sort of, you know, possibly slightly hungover and shirt sort of untucked and everything, and he basically turned around and barked at us to tuck our this is England, tuck your shirts in, you know, raise, you know, sort yourself out, you're representing your country. And I still remember the sort of fear and adrenaline that sort of burst through me. I thought, wow, you know, he meant it, he was absolutely serious. And it was the sort of it was a great moment because you saw the pride in him and you know, just the minute he pulled on that shirt, what it meant for him. And he didn't want this, say, ragtag bunch behind him disgracing the shirt. We may have disgraced it on the pitch, I'm afraid. But it was just a really great moment. So Terry Butcher's my choice.
How did you get on then? You say you may have disgraced yourself on the pitch. What was? Do you remember the result?
Luckily, I don't remember the result. But we've had, I have to say, the England press team has not brought a lot of we've had even less success than the England national team, proper team on the pitch over the years. We've had a few humiliations down the line. I think there was one game we played actually against the famous Tomaszewski, the famous clown. Not sure it was that game, but I'm afraid the England press team has had some pretty mixed results down the line.
Well, we'll swiftly move on from them then. And I know, Gregor, you mentioned Des Walker then as the one captain you remember fondly playing under. What about if there was any captain, past or present, that you could have played with? Who would it have been?
I can't look beyond Roy Keane. I honestly can't, because, and I say that knowing that I would have simultaneously loathed playing alongside him, but knowing at the same time that he would have elevated my play and the team's. So, like, I honestly hated playing with people whose kind of default mode was a moaner. And there's a lot of them. And Roy Keane was kind of, moaning was more kind of visceral, obviously. But I know, you know, you look beyond that if you win. And he would have helped me play better, and he would have helped us win.
Roy Keane, I like it. That is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to you, Matt. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. We will be back with you on Thursday for the very latest game podcast. Do stay safe in the meantime.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.